This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're spending the hour with the author of a new novel based in part on his experience as a lobbyist in Indiana. We're joined now by Michael Leppert, lecturer at the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a Political Thriller. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Miriam.
Later in the show, we're going to get more into detail on the experiences you had at the Indiana State House and the lessons you learned. But I want to start with this new book and learn more about how this all came together. When did you decide to write this, and what was the initial idea behind it?
Well, the initial idea, the inspiration, or the decision to write extensively about the topic in the book was made while the real life version of the story was unfolding in 2015, 2016, back in that range. I knew from what I was seeing and what I was experiencing that I wanted to write about it. And so the question really at that time was how to do that, not whether or not to do it. So the real life story was a pretty good one all on its own. So it gave me the inspiration to tell it. And so then the question became, how do you tell this story? How do you tell it in a way that will reach people and reach people that I think need to be exposed to it?
What made you decide to turn it into fiction versus telling a first person experience narrative of this?
Yeah, you know, I had published a book in 2016 that was a chronicle of columns that I write, and I write every week and have for seven or eight years now. And that collection of columns, it turned out to be a book that I'm very proud of, but not overly interesting to people who aren't here from Indiana. And so when I was considering the next book, my decision was I wanted people to see what was happening here and make it, tell it so that it's useful to people beyond just the political junkies that would be inclined to buy it no matter what, no matter how I told the story. That was the primary driver right then. I had a little bit of experience with my first book, and so when I decided to tell this story, I was pretty methodical about how to tell it so that more people could get use out of it than just the people who I knew would be intuitively interested in it.
Do you think that writing it fiction style lost any important elements, or if you had written it nonfiction, would have lost elements? You know, either way, was there something gained or lost?
You know, I haven't had any experience or any feedback yet that leads me to believe that I chose poorly on that. But you know, like I said a minute ago, the real story was interesting, creative in a bad way, and all of that. I think it's difficult for a political corruption whistleblower type story that exists in a state house to be interesting to people outside of that state house unless it can be told in a way that's engaging beyond those borders, and that was the goal. I think that if we spent a lot of time in a more journalistic approach, a nonfiction approach, it might be viewed, and this is something I wanted to avoid, as a book that serves as an expose of certain people, certain acts, and that I wanted to tell a story that was broader than that.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. Just certain journalistic things come off as maybe a little bit too insider for folks, whereas if you have a story or something interesting, like I do comedy and stuff, and I find that that's a way to tell stories, and maybe there's a moral in there or a lesson, but it's not right. Super serious.
Right. Yeah.
Are you worried at all that people who read this will spend the whole time trying to figure out who or what is being referenced from real life?
I'm not worried because I know I'm certain of it. we had a release party on Friday night, and I tried to be pretty intentional about telling this to the people at the party that for people who were around when this happened and know, you know, the media reports were actually in the building when this thing was unfolding over the course of 2 or 3 years. And people who are just familiar with how things operate over there, it's going to be a bit of a chore for them to read this without trying to read it through their eyes, you know, hear the story or remember the story, you know, from their perspective. And so I feel sorry for the people who bought the book first, because those are the people who already have a sense of who characters are and places and processes. But it's important, and I'll tell everybody this, I didn't write the book for those people. If I had, I might have been more paranoid about every little thing that's in it from that respect. But yeah, I feel sorry for people who are just inclined to go out and buy this and read it right now. And a lot of people have already, because they, you know, they already know a little bit about it. And, you know, the way I describe something that they see every day might be different than the way they would. And so that burden is real. And I'm already getting some feedback that makes that clear. But I was pretty confident that was going to happen anyway.
If you have any questions or comments, you can jump in on the conversation by reaching out to us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Michael Leppert, lecturer at the Kelley School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a political thriller. I have to say, I don't know that I've ever heard of those two words together, political and thriller.
I will tell you that is not the way I described it. I'm learning a lot about publishing books in the process of putting out my debut novel, and that's one of them. I didn't consider it to be a thriller. I would have called it historical drama is what I would have called it. But yeah, I guess it could be thrilling to some. I've had people make fun of that, and I certainly have too behind the scenes. But there are some thrilling parts of it, that's for sure.
Since you lived the experiences that you wrote about, that you fictionalized, do you feel like this was a therapeutic process to be able to write about it?
Yeah. And that, first of all, absolutely. All of my writing feels therapeutic in nature. But yeah, I spent about 9 months writing this. And I don't think that my next novel is going to take me 9 months. Just because of preparation and some other things that I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about. But yeah, the therapy behind telling a story that you didn't think everybody really knew in total. You know, people would read the story of the week in whatever media was reporting on it. But I think one of the things about a story that lasts as long as this one did, and it was strung out over about 3 years, people lose context over time until you can back away and tell it in total. And so that part of it was very therapeutic. But, you know, I had someone give me a compliment a couple of weeks ago that just has struck me. And I think about it every day since then, that the person who reads my column said, "You sure seem to enjoy writing it." And I absolutely enjoyed writing this book, just like I enjoy writing my column. So there's a bit of therapy in all the writing that I do.
I think it's really cool, too, that you're able to be a novelist now. You know, I think a lot of us have a dream one day we'll write a book or a novel. What was the toughest thing for you when it came to writing this book?
One of the toughest things about this, and I think this has surprised most of the people that I've spoken to about it so far, is that I wanted to tell a story that was entertaining and efficient and memorable, the characters be memorable and the scenery be memorable. And to do all that, it's hard to, you know, you have to be cognizant and you have to constantly be reading your writing from the perspective of the reader instead of, you know, what you think they need to hear. You need to be able to connect with them. And so in the process of trying to do that, and also trying to be true to the process of the story that happened in real life, that real life part becomes a real burden. Because the details of this saga are plentiful. I mean, there are a lot of details involved, and so I didn't want to tell that part of the story in a half baked kind of way. I wanted people to understand from start to finish how these kinds of things work, and not detract from it, because what actually happened was pretty good as it is. I didn't want to fictionalize the process part of it, and so that was probably the hardest part. People probably think, well, he had this backdrop of this story, which made it easy to make this up. You know, that made it less intimidating at the start, but I wasn't too deep into the process before I figured out, boy, this is going to be hard. I'm going to have to stay disciplined on that part. And so that's the number one thing that made it hard for me.
A few years ago, you wrote a book called Contrary to Popular Belief, A Chronicle of a Progressive in Indiana, and that was nonfiction. Mm-hmm. How was the difference working on that versus this new novel?
That was a lot more like a jigsaw puzzle that I had all the pieces in front of me. I didn't realize when I was writing those first couple of years, when I first started writing my column, how I was just naturally drawn to certain topics. I knew what I cared about, but I didn't know that I'd written 5 or 6 columns about guns, or 8 or 10 columns about discrimination or refugees or whatever. When I sat back and said, I want to do a chronicle of this stuff, and the timing, we were headed into the 2016 election when I was putting that together. I had the material, and what I was doing was basically just connecting the dots of topics, and that was fun. But it was also, by comparison, much, much easier to do than this most recent book, that's for sure. If you're writing installments and you're putting into a chronology, now that I've done that before and I've done this now, I look back and writing a long form story from start to finish is definitely more of a challenge than piecing together what you were already creating on a weekly basis. So I may do more of those chronicles in the future, because now that I've been down this road a couple of times, I know how to do it.
Speaking of being down the road a couple times, is it difficult to get novels like the one that you just published published?
That's why I finished writing this in October of 2018, and 3 years it took to get from the finishing of the first draft of the manuscript to our conversation today, a little over 3 years. And I wasn't knocking on doors and trying to impress publishers that entire time. It got pretty frustrating very early on. The book business is one that I don't really understand, and don't understand it much better today than I did a year ago when I first started talking to Greenleaf Book Group, who was the publisher. And I actually contacted Greenleaf about a different book idea, and they responded to it and were excited about it. And when we got to talking about it, it became pretty clear that the timing of the original book idea wasn't exactly optimal. And in the course of that conversation, I said, "Well, I've got this novel that I've written." They were like, "You got a novel on the shelf? Let's see that." And 3 days later, they were like, "We want to publish this one right now."
Nice. Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with former lobbyist and author Michael Leppert about his new novel. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. With us again is Michael Leppert, lecturer at the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a Political Thriller. And apologies if you hear some tapping in the background. The neighbors again have decided to do construction. So I can't predict these things. But Michael, we're talking about your book. And before the break, something that crossed my mind was, you are a former lobbyist. And why would someone who's worked in that field come out and do sort of a whistleblower novel about the field? I guess in my impression, a lobbyist enjoys the whole way things work.
I'm not sure that expectation or prediction or stereotype is completely accurate. Most of the people who are in the business of lobbying, not all, but most, got involved with government because they cared about governing, or they cared about public service of some kind, or were involved with an issue that was attractive to them. And so I think a lot of people assume that every lobbyist is like the character from Thank You for Smoking, and all they're doing is trying to close deals and make money, and they don't care about anything but those things. And I don't think that's an accurate description of the lobby in general. It's certainly not a description of my approach to the business, especially the last half of my career. And that's part of the tale of the book, that, the human element in all of this is what people, I think, underestimate. You see headlines about the news of the day with regard to government and politics, and I think what often gets lost or not factored into people's consumption of that information is that the guy who made that good decision or bad decision on Monday was having a bad day for a whole list of other reasons, or you know, is going through a human experience that no one is reporting on. And the truth is that how we approach our daily lives, you know, fluctuates based on what our state of mind is. And that's as true in the lobbying business as it is in any business, and for that matter, in the political and government business as well. So that's a big part of the reason why I told the story, because those kinds of things. I mean, I look at whistleblowers like Francis Haugen and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman from the Trump White House, and who knows if they would have done what they did in their whistleblowing role if they had been at a different place in their lives. And the truth is that the answer to that question is probably not. They probably would have made a different decision, maybe not completely different, but it might have varied somehow. And those kinds of things have a real impact on people's lives.
As a lobbyist, or I should say former lobbyist, what was your role? What did you do with lawmakers?
What did I do?
What was the background of your work that you were working on?
Yeah, well, when I... The last part of my career in government, I was the executive director of the Utility Regulatory Commission. And one of my jobs at that time in the late 90s, early 2000s, was to advocate for a legislative agenda that our chairman at the time and the governor's office under Governor Frank O'Bannon wanted to accomplish, that were policy changes. And that's how I ended up working in the State House to begin with. I had just gone to work for state government out of college and had you know, gone to various jobs and promotions and sort of ended up there by accident with an assignment from people who were, you know, my bosses. And so I was over there advocating, you know, these changes and that changes from the perspective of a regulator. And that's where my, that was my entree into the business. And then when I left government, I became a consultant to do those things in the private sector. And I had a lot of different kinds of clients over the years. You know, my base for the most part, always revolved around utilities because that was my area of expertise when I left government. But we did a lot of general business interests and I ended up doing a lot of not-for-profit work, conservation, environmental stuff, human interest things, you know, all kinds of things by the time my career wound down earlier this year. But I was all over the board. I was in a lot of different rooms and a lot of different campaigns.
And little did people know you were taking notes of what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And the important part of that is I'm not the only one. There are a lot of us that take notes. There are a lot of people that have great stories to tell. If we could lock all the people that I worked with in a room and tell stories, it would take a long time to hear them all. That's for sure.
You went into this, into government work right out of college. Did you have sort of a different impression going in as somebody that was green, so to speak? And then when you left, I guess I'm wondering, were you still hopeful for change or did you feel disappointed and like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was?
Oh, wow. No, I'm not disappointed, and I'm still not. You know, I think a lot of people would read this book and have conversations with me about this particular story and think that I left the business with some sour taste in my mouth and just couldn't take it anymore. And it really isn't about that. That's not where I'm at now. But from the time that I got there, I learned so much about the way things really are. And it's funny talking to people that, you know, all they know is from headlines and from short snippets of information that they'll get from social media or you know, short stories in other forms of media. You know, there's just so much that goes on. There's so much to learn. There's so much to know. And one of my classes that I teach a class outside of the Kelley School over at the O'Neill School, which is where I got my undergraduate degree, on this topic, on public law and government relations. And the class is going to start reading my book this weekend. And we're going to talk about this story and talk about, you know, how government really works so that people aren't as green as I was when I came out of college. There are good lessons, and they're not all terrible lessons. They're just things people should know.
If you're listening live and you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Michael Leppert, lecturer at the Kelley School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a Political Thriller. Michael, I don't want to give away too much about your book, but can you give us a little tease on what specifically or time period you're talking about and what was involved?
It covers a story, and the book is true to the calendar that occurred in the State House between 2015 and 2017.
Okay. I'm gonna dig in some archives here.
Yeah, there's plenty of media to find out there about the real story, but most of the procedural stuff and most of the calendar matches up with the mm-hmm. book.
Did any of this coincide with what was happening in the national political front with the Trump administration, or is this totally separate?
It was largely separate. There were a couple of things that I think contributed outside political influences. And again, there are a lot of things that go into how things happen, in our culture and in our government. The first session where this bad law and this bad scheme was pursued was during the session of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That was obviously a big deal here in Indiana in 2015. And so, a lot of the awfulness that happened with this saga was clearly under the shadow of something that was way larger in terms of scale and reach. And so those kinds of things have an impact on other things. Those shadows actually have a purpose. They shadow out, other things that are going on at the time. So that was one thing. I think that the election of 2016 may have had an impact on what the federal government decided to do with what seemed to be a very questionable approach to public service. When the party of the president changes, so do political appointees. U.S. attorneys change, and the decision to investigate further and those kinds of things change, and relationships change. And so There are theories that the change in power after the 2016 election did have an impact on how much this was pursued, but certainly the original law was passed under the shadow of RFRA back in 2015, and I think that provided some cover to an original bad idea.
What was your impression working with the lawmakers at the State House overall? Did anything surprise you? I say this because I'm just thinking of it as someone from the outside, it seems like everyone's business as usual, just doing their job, going home. But is there more to the story there?
Well, I tell people this, and I think people are surprised to hear it from me, especially now and of late. I never met anybody who served as a legislator in the Indiana State House who didn't originally want to be that, want to serve in that role for anything but good reasons. So people decide to get involved with government usually because they care about taxes or they care about programs or they care about education or whatever it is. Freedoms could be anything. And so the original reason for people to make that choice is usually based in goodness, agree with it or not. There is a good reason why people get there. Now, what happens after you get there varies sharply. And who you align with and what sorts of rooms you end up in and what sorts of debates and initiatives that you become, connected with, whether you wanted to or not, have a way to impact your credibility, your productivity, your public service approach. And so sometimes people get off the track. And that happens when you're talking about large groups of people. Take 150 of the best people in the world and lock them in a building for a few months every winter, and there are going to be some people who do the wrong thing, and that's the State House here in Indiana is no exception to that. And sometimes I think that people just don't understand and lose track of that human element. I've said that before, but that's a big deal here. I don't think that the State House here is anything but made up of people who are originally there for the right reasons. But can sometimes lose their way in the process.
It reminds me a lot of student government in college for some mm-hmm. reason, where, everybody wants to do something, but then somehow you get swayed or excited about something else, and the message kind of fizzles out. Sure. But there's a quote from your book, and you said, "My purpose for telling this story is to bring light to the types of manipulation or control the American electorate cedes to others by not staying active in its governmental and political process at all levels." What kinds of things did you commonly see at the State House that would fit that description? And what do you mean by manipulation?
Well, I think that, you know, and I was a part of this process and the market of influence. And so when we talk about lobbying, lobbying is a very specific thing. And I was a lobbyist. But the market of influence is bigger than just lobbyists. There are campaign consultants and fundraisers and all of that. There are contributors and donors. There are people who knock on doors. The market of influence is a larger market than people think that it is. And so the purpose of this story in particular was something that the people of Indiana should have been outraged about. They should have been so concerned and so disturbed by everything about it that there should have been hell to pay. And what happened was the dust settled and people forgot about it and people moved on. Voters moved on and there were no consequences for what was obviously the wrong outcome and a lot of wrong things happened for it to last for as long as it did. And so that's what I mean. When they cede their control to other people, they had the opportunity as voters to look down the list of people who were involved with leading this horrible idea to its enactment and respond accordingly. And there wasn't any reaction to that at all. And those kinds of things happen commonly. It's not all that unusual. But you know, someone asked me a question a couple of weeks ago about this, and I talked about partisanship. The book doesn't have anything to do with partisanship, but I say, you know, a corrupt partisan is going to be corrupt first, not partisan first. You know, the partisanship for someone who's corrupt follows that. And so people talk about Republican and Democrat all the time and we're a divided nation and all that sort of stuff, but corruptness knows no party. And so once you've shown to the public that you have corrupt intent, your credibility is gone. And that applies in walks of life where credibility is everything, and in politics and lobbying, that it is everything. And so that's the giveaway that I think the public actively does by seeing something that was obviously corrupt, obviously wrong, and then not responding accordingly to it by choosing somebody else to represent them. And that's what happened in this case.
I think it's fascinating when it comes to political things, because I think, you know, people can see corruption or they can read the headlines or they can understand that something isn't right, but they don't always take the step to change it. And I wonder if it's because it just feels so intimidating and way out there. Like my one little change of voice or vote or whatever is not going to matter in the grand scheme of things because everything's rigged anyway. I think there's kind of this distrust among people.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that people are intimidated. Intimidated is a good word. And over the years, I've talked to a lot of groups about that very thing who think that calling their legislator or calling their congressman or their city councilor or their mayor's office is meaningless because it's just one phone call in it. You know, it's like one drop of water in an ocean of water. And that's just not that's not the experience that I've had in government, that those phone calls and those communications they're like gold. They're extremely valuable and people need to pick up the phone or get down in front of their keyboard. And instead of popping off on Facebook, send an email to your representative and say, you know what? I don't like this. I disagree with you on that. Or I would rather you do X, Y, or Z. Those things actually do matter. And, not just voting, but, you know, voting, yes, you absolutely need to vote and you need to vote wisely. But also just stay involved. I mean, the government is something that is ours. And a lot of times people think that I can vote every couple of years and let it run itself. And that's just not the way this is supposed to work. We're supposed to stay involved throughout the process. And those people need that contact. They need that connection.
I think also for marginalized communities of color who have, you know, a long historic lack of their voice being heard, it can also be really hard to want to be involved because it seems every step of the way some new roadblock is being put in front of them. Do you feel that Indiana has changed in that sense in becoming more of an open state for folks?
Oh, I think that you know, I got accused of this a little bit when I worked for government, because one of my charges was to deal directly with individual utility customers when I was at the utility commission. And I worked very hard when I was there to make it easier for people to contact us and to make it more efficient for us to be responsive to people in a short time and all that sort of stuff. And I got accused a couple of times of soliciting complaints from people by being more open and, you know, flashing open for business signs, call us if you've got a problem sort of thing. And I felt at the time successful at saying, you know what, if you're unhappy about it, then do better at your job. You know, that's what government should be doing, everything they can to invite people into the process instead of putting them off. And I think all of governments, even in states that claim all these great moves forward, you know, West Coast and other coastal states, I think we could all do better by inviting people into government instead of making it intimidating. It's the wrong, I think, mindset once you get inside. We should be doing everything to get more people involved.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're spending the hour today with Michael Leppert to talk about his new novel, Flipping the Circle, a political thriller. If you have questions or comments for our guest today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for it on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're speaking with Michael Leppert today, lecturer at the Kelley School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a political thriller. Michael, before the break, we started talking a little bit about trust in government and the public's trust. And the National Election Study has been measuring public trust in government since 1958. And although there was a small increase in the last couple of years, trust has gone down significantly overall. And I know this is a broad metric, but what do you think about how the public views government right now, especially related to the kinds of things you want people to know about?
I think there's just a lot of work to do, and I worry that people in government and around government, and I was both of those for the bulk of my career, need to take that kind of polling seriously. And I've seen those polls and shared that kind of information with my classes over time, and it's important. I mean, people need to have confidence the same confidence that I have when I communicate to people. People usually come to government for all the right reasons, and staying true to that is important. But it's a work that never ends. I mean, you can't be lazy, apathetic, or corrupt on Friday and come back in on Monday and start clean. You know, those kinds of things are commitments that need to be in place when you walk in the door, and you need to stay there. And so I think that not having confidence in government says a lot, but what are we all doing collectively to insist on more from our government? You know, these last few years, where I imagine there's been some deterioration just because of the partisan nature and the division that's in the country. No one trusts each other. Both sides of that equation have equal responsibility to do something about that. And I sometimes don't get the sense that the long term value of that is given enough priority in exchange for short-term benefit.
I want to talk about some of the lessons that you have taken away with your experience working in this realm, and then also this book, and what you want other people to learn from what you've gone through. Is there anything you hope sticks with people after they finish the book?
Well, I think one of the people who read the book before it came out talked a little bit about this with me and commented on the cover for me, Andrew Stoner, who I met when he was working in government 20 years ago, before he went off to be a professor in a variety of schools. But, you know, he's a thinker. And what I want people to know is that we still do have control of this. I think a lot of people, based on the polling you just mentioned, you know, we really do have control. We get into the habit of acting like it's too big and thinking that we don't matter individually, and those sorts of things. And I consider all those to be thinking errors. I really do. I think that people need to understand that their involvement, their engagement actually does matter. It matters even right now when they may not believe that it does. It still does. And so we have to get back into the habit of understanding that this is our own garden. You know, we have to go out and weed it, and we have to tend to it, and it grows and it dies, and it grows and it dies. And we have to do all of those things consistently. It's never going to change. It's never going to go away. And so all of us collectively have to, I think, have a healthier attitude about what our role is and what our responsibilities are there. And if that would improve a little bit, our confidence probably would rise with it.
You mentioned earlier sort of this market of influence that's been growing, and it seems like it's taken on a world of its own. Would you say that being involved in lobbying in some form is better than actually running for a position?
Boy, what a great question. there are so many ways to be impactful. I don't think that the only way to be impactful is to go out and run and win an election. There are times when I felt like what I was doing was the best possible way for me to contribute to whatever it was in front of me. As a lobbyist, you know, as an advocate for something, lobbyists are always viewed as just doing things for money, but there were a lot of really important things, you know, bias crimes legislation and other kinds of conservation stuff that I did over time, where I was the guy running the campaign, and these were all things that were, you know, all about making human progress. Being involved is the real measure. Are you going to be involved and engaged in this thing or not? And so there are lots of ways to do that. There are lots of ways to be involved. You don't have to run for office to do it. It's a great thing if you do. You can advocate and you can write letters and you can organize campaigns and you can hold people accountable without running for office. And all of those things collectively matter a lot more than I think the current culture believes them to do.
Is there anything that makes it more difficult for folks to get involved in local politics than it should be? I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, has it become sort of this like insiders club, and people sort of have this order of people like, you're next, and then we're going to work for you to get you up on the ballot, and then next time it's your turn. How does that work out?
Well, I think the biggest barrier, the biggest barrier for people being more involved is the time that it takes. I spend a good chunk of most lectures in my public law class talking about time, and that's just not from the respective citizen involvement, but also from advocacy involvement and from legislative and process involvement. We see a lot of this in the news right now, deadlines being issued and then broken and reissued and all that sort of stuff has been, you know, a big exercise of late in Washington. But time, I think, is the thing that we in the private sector is so valuable. You know, if you get on a website right now, they're timing you. They want to know how long you're on their website, and they want to know how successful they can be in closing a sale with you based on how much time you're on that website. The same applies with government. You know, it should be easy and it should be convenient to vote, but it should also be convenient to participate in a public meeting or a public forum. It should be very convenient to communicate, and there shouldn't be a bunch of barriers. And neither side of that communication is served with that inefficiency built in. And so my thing is not really about limiting influence as much as it is about making it easier and more convenient and taking less time for people to be involved. You know, people are busy. You spend 12 hours a day working your job and taking care of your family, and you've got 15 minutes to give away to your government. That 15 minutes should be enough time, or that 5 minutes should be enough time for you to voice your concern in an efficient way so that the people who need to hear it can hear it. And that's probably the number one thing that I would focus on, dealing with time.
Absolutely. I think time is definitely a key thing for folks to keep in mind, because people who aren't in the day-to-day politics, you know, have other lives outside of it. The other thing I was thinking of, just as a journalist, when I used to cover government meetings or go to things, you do feel a little awkward sometimes going into a committee room or something. It's like, am I okay to be in here? You know, like, so some kind of more welcoming thing, but I guess people don't want to welcome journalists in case there's something they don't want us to know. But in general, I'm just thinking for folks to want to attend meetings and get involved, just making it feel like it's for everyone.
Yeah, I see. And I was the other extreme. When I worked for government, I very early was given assigned the task of dealing with the media. And so the media to me were like royalty. I mean, when they showed up, it was like, can I get you a cup of coffee? You know, well, what can I do to make your stay here more pleasant? That was the way I was trained. And the person who trained me on how to deal with the media was a former reporter. So that always stuck with me. But the same thing, there's a scene in the book where the lead character in the book has to sign his name to get into a public meeting. And he takes issue with it, a small issue. And it's a little quirky conversation, but that in and of itself is an unnecessary burden. Why should I have to sign in to come into this meeting? It's public. And, mm-hmm. and those kinds of little things, they erode people's desire and willingness to be involved. And all those little things collectively really are things that we ought to look at and be intolerant of, because our time is just as important as those dignitaries who were sitting behind the bench making these big decisions. Those people work for us, and they should be welcoming to us and inviting us in and getting us a cup of coffee when we come in to be involved with it. That's always been my approach to public involvement, and I think everyone should adopt that. Our trust in government would go up immediately if we did that.
That's a good perspective to have, to say you work for me. And it's hard to see that, because I think sometimes you feel like maybe I work for them because I'm supposed to follow all the rules.
Oh yeah, well, you feel that way, and that's part of the story in the book. I remember when I first walked into the State House. And I've been in lots of state houses now. And you go in and there's huge, limestone walls and all these big, leather-backed chairs and sir and the honorable and all those kinds of words are used with the people who are in there. And it's all very intimidating for people who were there for the first time. It took me a year to get used to all that stuff and to get back to the reality of the situation is that these are just people just like I am. They've got a job to do just like I do. And we should be able to call them, Bob and Betty and get on with the work at hand instead of, going through all these, charades that separate people.
What is it like being a progressive and trying to enact change in Indiana and the Republican majority state house?
It's exhausting. No, you have to pick your spots. Yeah. And that was the case even when government was more shared. It's frustrating, and it would be equally frustrating, I think, for a lot of Hoosiers if it were flipped around the other way. And in any state where it's too lopsided, most lobbyists are going to tell you, people who are at this business for a long time, that equally divided government is really the way to go. That's the time when really bad ideas get filtered, get modified, or just get buried. And it's also a time, much like we're seeing in Congress right now, people are unhappy with the process on these big bills that President Biden is supporting. The majorities out there are so thin, they can't just be cavalier about doing these things, and they have to be cognizant of other interests, not just the most loud voice in the room. And so being a progressive in Indiana right now is not ideal, obviously. But I wouldn't want it to be flipped around the other way for very long either, because I think that we're all served if we can listen to everybody and come up with a solution that works for the most of us instead of just the loudest or the people occupying power at the time.
Mm-hmm. So a nice happy balance in the middle.
Oh yeah. And when I first worked in the state house, there was that balance. The Senate was Republican, the House was Democrat. Our governor in Indiana is a very weak position with regard to policy changes legislatively, with a simple majority veto authority for the legislature. And so having the chamber split, prevented a lot of bad ideas from becoming law. And the process is hard enough as it is, but that extra layer of check and balance on one another is extremely valuable. So most of the states are all one party or the other. And I think that is this period of time where that's true is going to prove to be a period of some really bad policymaking.
I want to go back to your class that you mentioned earlier, that you teach a college class about a lot of these issues. What have you heard from students anything surprising coming from them? I feel like the students today are maybe Gen Z or somewhere along that line where they have a lot of social media, and so they get a lot of information coming at them. So I wonder how they're able to process all of this stuff.
You know, the younger generation is an exciting one for me. I mean, obviously I spend most of my time with, you know, the 18 to 22 year old crowd now. So I hope that their youthfulness is rubbing off on me a little bit, but they, you know, they care about a lot of things that I think people don't give them credit for. And there are some things that are just perfunctory in this generation that, you know, that are just, you know, embedded in them that are not embedded in my generation. I'm 54 years old, and there are a lot of people my age who haven't adjusted to seeing LGBT people and, you know, as an equal, you know, that the racial strife, and the racial perspective is different in my generation than theirs. The environmental and the climate challenges are different. So you talk to somebody, any of my students that are, you know, 18, 20, 22 years old, and you talk to them about burning coal, and they're going to look at you like, I can't believe we still do that, you know, or, you know, discriminating, being able to fire somebody because they're a member of the LGBT community, or restricting who can be a victim of a hate crime because of a member in one minority group or another, or their lack of membership in one of those groups. And the younger generation just looks at you and they don't even understand what the problem is. And that gives me a lot of optimism that some of the things that I've struggled with my whole adult life don't make much sense. I see them seeing them with a more objective and a more healthy view than people who've grown up with other baggage. And so I have a lot of optimism for the future with the people that I've been around the last few months in school, that's for sure.
I was going to ask you if you were worried at all about the future of politics here in Indiana, but it sounds like you're optimistic.
Oh, I'm very, very optimistic. And this group is not, they're not all uniformly classic Democrats or leftists. I think a lot of them are have a libertarian streak in them, but they don't see a reason why when they look at a problem. This is the school shooting generation. They look at school shootings and they think, why do we keep letting this happen? You know, there has to be something that we should do. Inaction makes no sense to them because there's clearly a problem. And so those kinds of things, that's the kind of feedback I get from my students. We just finished reading the book that Shannon Watts wrote for Moms Demand. And the reason why we're writing it, it's not because of the gun issue. We're reading it because of movements. The class, I didn't realize this until we got done with the book, how much they really enjoyed that book. They really loved that story, loved the book. So those kinds of things are and other feedback is just, it's very encouraging to me that the people who take over in the future are going to be just fine.
We have about a minute left. Any words of wisdom for folks who may want to dip their toe in the water and get involved? You know, what should they start with?
Well, I would tell them not to dip their toe in the water. I would tell them cannonball right in the middle of the pond. That's what I would tell them. This anybody who thinks that there's a barrier, they should be intolerant of what they think that barrier is, whatever it is. If it's a time thing, if it's a signing your name in to get to a public meeting, if it's a voter registration, mistake or problem or challenge, you know, keep charging ahead. Don't let anybody deter you, and always approach government and politics as if it belongs to you, because it does. And that whole ownership, act like an owner. The firm that I just left always told us to act like we own the place, because we do. That's exactly how people ought to treat their government here. Act like you own it, because you do.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Michael Leppert, lecturer at the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a Political Thriller. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.